Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today on the broadcast, the vote in Athens, and more importantly, the aftermath. How to run the country's biggest public university on an ever-decreasing budget. And forget dinks and yuppies. Are you a Henry? Don't worry, we'll explain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 18th of June. Glad to have you with us. The results of the Greek election yesterday are mostly a roster of what didn't happen. The Eurozone didn't collapse. Global markets didn't implode. The streets of Athens didn't riot. Instead, the pro-bailout party won the most seats, so it'll make another stab at forming a government. And the rest of us will try to figure out what it all means. Joe Weisenthal covers Wall Street and the global economy for the Business Insider. He has been in Athens for the past week or so, looking around, asking questions. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the vibe? What's it like on the streets of Athens today?
I mean, it's pretty calm on the streets of Athens. Actually, I think people have been wondering about this, whether there's any sort of sense of panic or whatever it is, but there really hasn't been any. It's quiet. I think if someone were just coming in here and didn't know anything about the political situation, no one would actually think there was anything particularly special happening.
It seems to me what we got yesterday was neither salvation nor the apocalypse. Is that your sense?
Yeah, that's exactly right. But the current status quo is nothing to cheer about at all. It's not clear whether the government, assuming it forms, will have any sort of power, which is to say whether they can maintain their coalition or whether they can convince the rest of Europe to renegotiate the bailout, give Greece some breathing room, inject some confidence and growth into the economy. So we're stuck in a very unpleasant place. And I think, you know, we're starting to crisis fatigue, and just this sort of endless nature of it all is really starting to weigh on people.
I was reading your Twitter feed this morning. You said one of the things that surprised you was that you had sympathy for Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, this morning.
That is something I've been surprised about. Before I came to Greece, I was very critical of the Germans. I thought that basically it was their straight, you know, that the main story was their intransigence about providing more money that told a big part of the story. And I still largely feel that way. But when you talk to Greeks and you hear them talk about the corruption and incompetence of their own government and how thorough and pervasive that view is, it becomes understandable how an outsider would be much less comfortable about opening up a blank check in the form of euro bonds or bank deposit guarantees.
Mm-hmm. There is a market question to ask you today, and that is why there hasn't been all that much of a reaction, specifically here stateside, right? I mean, is that because fundamentally nothing changed?
I think that's exactly right. Fundamentally nothing changed. This election outcome is kind of what was expected for the last couple of weeks. The buzz had been that probably New Democracy was going to pull out a narrow victory.
New Democracy being the pro-bailout party.
New Democracy is the pro-bailout conservative party. So the sense people had was that they were probably going to pull out a narrow victory. And so to some extent, this was already expected. But then, as you say, Greece is nowhere closer to resolving this crisis. Europe is nowhere closer to resolving this crisis at the end of the election. And therefore, you can see why the markets aren't particularly enthused.
You know how people in business journalism the past couple of years have been saying, man, if Greece goes under, it's going to be really, really bad for us. I wonder whether people here in the States have just stopped paying attention, because so far there's been nothing bad for us.
Yeah, I think that the idea of the Greek exit being Greek going bankrupt or Greece exiting the Eurozone, I don't think too many people think that is the trigger that would be a situation for the United States. I think if a Greece exit then led to a domino effect where we had Spanish banks failing and a run on Italy and so on. But I think people have a hard time grasping it all. I just don't think people have any sort of intuitive sense of that.
What is the meaning then of Greece to the States? If it's not, you know, them leaving the euro, what is it then for us?
I think the issue is Greece is not really about Greece leaving the euro, at least from the broader global perspective. However, Greece represents a political failure. If Greece leaves the euro, the big issue is that the eurozone itself becomes threatened. So not Greece exiting specifically being the issue, but I think people question whether the whole project can be saved.
Joe Weisenthal is the deputy editor at the Business Insider. You can read his Twitter feed at The Stalwart. It's a good one. Check it out. Joe, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
On Wall Street today, as I said, not a whole lot of reaction. Could have been better. Could have been worse, too. Much worse had the Greek election gone a different way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a time in our lives when my wife and I were dinks. Double income, no kids. Also, we were yuppies. Young, upwardly mobile urban professionals. Today, sad to say, I learned I've become a Henry. High earner, not rich yet. Apparently, though, I'm behind the times. Henrys have been around for a while. 2003 is when the term first appeared, I'm told. But it's coming back into vogue as the economy tries to get itself going again. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
Pam Danzinger is president of Unity Marketing. Her company researches the spending habits of high-end consumers, so she's very friendly with the Henrys.
The term Henry, H-E-N-R-Y, stands for high earners, not rich yet.
If you're a Henry, and 20% of Americans are, it means you earn about $100,000 to $250,000 a year. You're probably married, and you're shopping at Banana Republic or Bloomingdale's, but probably not at Barney's. Henry spend a lot.
They account for more than 40% of all total U.S. consumer spending. So they're the heavy lifters in the economy.
And retailers are relying on them more than ever. Carl Obermiller teaches marketing at Seattle University's Albers School of Business. He says the middle class and the poor don't have as much spending power as the Henrys, and the rich are scaling back.
The rich have a lot of money to spend, too, but the rich already have spent a lot of what they're going to spend their money on.
Back in 2011, there was a huge spike in spending by the ultra-rich. It was pent-up demand after the recession. But just when the Henrys are needed, they're nervous. There's the shaky stock market and fears of a global recession.
When the economy goes up, they tend to be confident and buoyed by that. And when the economy goes down, they also tend to be threatened by that.
That's why Pam Danzinger says the Henry spending is only slowly creeping up. But at least they don't have it as bad as the sitcoms. That's single income, two children, and oppressive mortgage. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
There are still 5 months left yet before Election Day, but presidential campaign 2012 is already getting expensive. The most recent reports from the Obama and Romney camps show the two sides have spent, combined, nearly $200 million so far, almost a quarter of that in a single state. Is it Florida? No, it's not. Is it Ohio? No, it's not. Shannon Mullen has what's what.
Would you believe Massachusetts? Mitt Romney and President Obama spent $45 million in the Bay State last year through the first quarter of this year on everything from pizza and postage to voter research and ad buys. That's the most the pair shelled out in any state so far, according to expense reports the campaigns filed with the Federal Election Commission. Massachusetts is a longtime Democratic bastion, but the Romney campaign spent nearly 95% of the combined total. What gives? Romney's a former governor of Massachusetts and decided to locate his campaign headquarters in Boston. Much of his spending has been payroll for campaign staff. But President Obama has dropped more than $2.5 million in Massachusetts, spending more in only four other states, including Illinois, the home of his campaign. Harvard professor Steve Ansaldobreher teaches government and studies elections.
Part of the reason is that the academic community in Boston generates a lot of students who have training, have skills in managing databases, but are also political junkies. So this is a natural place to set up shop.
He says Massachusetts has lots of political consultants and data analysis companies that crunch numbers for national campaigns and find new ways to work the web for donations. Obama's paid hundreds of thousands to two telemarketing firms in the Boston area, but traditional media has also gotten a nod in the spending spree. The production company that makes Romney's TV ads is based in Massachusetts.
Mitt Romney's strong leadership will make all the difference on jobs.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Romney's paid that same company more than $18 million to place his ads in markets around the country, so those dollars end up out of state. But Steve Ansala-Behar says plenty of money stays in the local economy through payments to restaurants, caterers, hotels, office suppliers.
All these are medium-sized and small businesses. There are very few really big businesses in the political campaign world, so it's all kind of helping small businesses in the United States.
Including Winston Flowers, an upscale Boston florist that counts Chanel and the Red Sox among its clients.
How are you?
Company president Ted Winston shows off a two-acre garden center filled with exotic plants and deluxe floral bouquets.
This is really our flagship location where we do everything from cut flowers to orchid plants to container gardening. We have greenhouses.
Winston worked with Mitt Romney when he was governor and now sends floral arrangements as thank you gifts to donors. But Winston's equal opportunity. He's done flowers for an Obama White House state dinner and later worked a Boston campaign event for the president.
Both campaigns have the confidence in what we do. It's an honor, and it kind of validates us.
Some of the biggest spending is still to come as November approaches. With all those swing states in play, it's hard to say whether Massachusetts will keep its edge. Both campaigns are expected to unleash millions more in spending across the country in the coming months, and that's economic stimulus both candidates can take credit for. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Coming up,
about 70% of jobs require no more than a high school diploma.
So why deal with all the stress and all the debt of a college degree? But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here's where we are this Monday. The Dow Industrials fell 0.2%. Today, 25 points, closed at 12,741. The Nasdaq picked up 0.75%, 22 points, 28.95 at the bell. The S&P 500 lifted 0.1%, 1 point. Finished at 1344. Europe's woes kept financial stocks down on Wall Street today. Morgan Stanley backed up 3.33%. Citigroup gave back 2.23% today. Goldman Sachs down more than 2%. Tech stocks mostly went the other direction. Facebook celebrated 1 month as a public company with a big day. Its shares clicked up more than 4.5%. Apple shined up 2%. Google gained 1.1% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.57%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for May. The Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on interest rates and the economy. And musician Ann Wilson of Heart turns 62. Happy birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Greek election's over with. Not that it changed very much, but there is more to the debt crisis over there than just Athens, you know, like all the other countries in the Eurozone, which gets us to today's installment of
What's Up?
What's Up?
What's Up, Europe?
To Spain we go, Madrid specifically, and journalist Miguel Ancho Morado once again. Miguel, it's good to have you back.
My pleasure.
So were you guys following this with as much fervor as it was followed over here, which was quite a bit, I have to tell you?
Well, I think with more fervor because, we are next on the line. We knew that everybody would be looking at Spain right after the electoral results would be known in Greece. And as it happens, well, we were right to be worried because it didn't matter that the good guys, as the Spanish prime minister put it, won the election. The fact is that our bond yields are again going up, and they have crossed the threshold of the 7%, which is a very scary figure. So it means that if this was a make or break moment, it's more break than make in the case of Spain.
Is there a sense of trepidation over there? I mean, is there fear, do you think?
I think fear is beginning to set in. But in the last 2 weeks, it's become clear that nothing works, that the bailout for our banks has not worked, that now Greece, which was the great hope of the Spanish government, they were saying that if the situation calmed in Greece, then the markets would stop punishing Spain. This didn't happen. It's not happening, at least today. So it looks like we're heading towards a full bailout and the intervention of the Spanish economy, and that's very, very worrying.
Are Spaniards, I guess the only way to say this is to say it, are Spaniards sick and tired of all this yet?
Well, certainly, because this is lasting so long. We are faced with, never a dull moment. Every week we have a new emergency. So if it were not tragic, it would be almost comic.
The press, of course, is full of all this news about the bailout and the Greek vote and all that. But what are real people talking about when they go out for a cup of coffee in the afternoon?
Well, they talk about the bailout, but probably in different terms than the government or the media or the economist. They wonder what this means for their everyday life, not exactly what it means for the economy of the country, because that is difficult to understand, is difficult to grasp for the man and the woman in the street. So they wonder how much it's going to cost them personally. And I think it's quite a logical question to ask yourself these days.
Miguel Ancho Morado in Madrid for us. Miguel, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We are, as one hopes we all know by now, being tracked every instant that we're online. Every website, every click, every little thing we do online, somebody knows about. Those somebody's, of course, being advertisers. A study out today from the data security company Crux looked at some of the busiest sites on the web. And the data goes like this. About a year ago, 10 or so pieces of consumer data were picked up from a typical website visit. Now it's 5 times that. And to add insult to cyber injury, advertisers are converting that data to sales pitches faster than ever before. Marketplace's Queen of Kim has that story.
Irene Lim was killing time online looking for vacation packages for her family. And as she kept searching,
I'm just getting a barrage of all these ads from Expedia, from Priceline, from all these other agencies. And it was just like, wow, okay, now people know.
But they didn't know everything, because long after Lim decided against the vacation,
I keep getting alerts of different flights, different hotel packages.
Lim was being targeted by a growing number of companies who track your actions on the web and then sell that information to the highest bidder immediately. It's called real-time advertising, and it's done by computers. Rebecca Lieb is an analyst at Altimeter Group. She says that type of advertising is often cheaper and more effective than a display ad on a homepage.
With the explosion of companies that are selling advertising in this space, it is growing considerably in popularity.
And the information can be sold and resold to target you again and again. And that's where the ads start missing the mark. Remember how Lim kept getting the ads for vacations even after she stopped looking? Gordon McLeod is the CEO of Crux, the company behind the study.
There's a whole daisy chain of collectors that are scraping data off websites.
So the next time you decide to go looking online for dining room chairs, expect to be reminded of them for a very long time. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
The state of California has finished dealing with part of its big fiscal problem. Last week, after much wrangling, legislators did manage to pass a budget, although Governor Jerry Brown does still have to sign the thing. And then there's the small matter of taxes. Governor Brown wants to raise them. He's got a proposition on the November ballot for voters to consider, money that will go in part to pay for public education out here, higher education included, assuming, again, the ballot measure passes. Mark Udoff is the president of the University of California system. That's UCLA, UC Berkeley, and eight other campuses. Mr. Udoff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Glad to be here.
So the state of California now has a budget on time for the first time in a while. What happens? What does it mean now for the University of California system?
Well, I think there's going to be there will be additional deliberation still. If this budget passes and if the November ballot measure passes, I think it means relatively good news for the University of California. If it goes bad, if that is if somehow the budget goes awry or the voters don't approve the ballot measure to raise revenues, it would be pretty disastrous for the University of California.
You're betting then on Californians being willing to tax themselves to improve the state of higher education.
I am placing that bet, but I don't really have much of a choice. If we go the other way, then tuition is going to be going up, and I think we're going to have some major issues in terms of access and quality.
You know, you mentioned problems of access, and with tuition rising and class size increases and offerings being cut, how do you keep, since this is your job, how do you keep the University of California a place where low- and middle-income kids can go to get a high-quality education?
You know, the tuition is $12,000 a year. That's the sticker price. The average tuition actually paid is $4,400 a year. Over 50% of our students pay no tuition at all. What I'm saying really is we can continue to take care of the low income. I'm more worried about the middle class. We need to get this right because at the end of the day, the problem's going to be not so much for the families making under $60,000, but maybe it's going to be for the families making between, say, $90,000 and $150,000, where they're not wealthy enough to just write a check and not lose sleep over it, and they really don't qualify for all those financial aid programs.
When you're sitting in meetings with the governor's policy advisors, his education team, do you guys ever consider just scrapping the whole thing and trying to come up with some new model for higher education? I mean, the University of California way back when led the way in higher education.
Well, we are looking at those new models. You're perfectly right. We have an e-learning pilot. So you may find 10 years from now that more significant portion of our curriculum is offered online. We lower our marginal cost. We accommodate more students. I'm visiting with the major corporations in California. They need to step up. We need $350 million in the next few years in scholarships. God knows university, the word university and efficiency really never went together in the same sentence. And what we're trying to do is to cut our costs. As I look at the prices and so forth, I agree the financial model is pretty much at the end of its line.
Do you think everybody should go to college? I mean, is higher education for everybody?
I don't think everyone should go. I think, you know, there are questions of people's aptitude and there are questions of people's interest. I'm a big believer in community colleges. Maybe you can transfer to a four-year. If you don't want to transfer to a four-year, that's fine with me. But I'm also a big believer in everyone gets a chance.
Do you ever wish you could just go back and be a law professor?
There are days when I wish I could go back and be a law professor. And I remember reading an article today which asked, can anyone really be a successful president of the United States? There seems to be a certain amount of pessimism. And you could say the same thing about university presidents, particularly in the public sphere. It's very hard when all you're doing is trying to keep the whole operation together to feel good about the impact you've had. But times will get better, and 50 years from now, it'll still be the great University of California.
Mark Udoff is the president of the University of California. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai. Enjoyed it.
You just heard Mark Udoff talking about some of the changes coming to higher education here in California and possibly elsewhere in the United States, one of which, perhaps, is that not everybody should go to college. Commentator Robert Samuelson has some thoughts on that.
It's time to ditch the College for All crusade. Like the crusade to make all Americans homeowners, it's doing more harm than good. True, the expansion of colleges after World War II helped democratize what had been an elitist privilege. In 1940, only 5% of Americans had completed college. Now, about 30% have a bachelor's degree, and another 10% have associate degrees. But we've overdone the college obsession. It's become the be-all and the end-all of K-12 schooling. If you don't go to college, you failed, even though about 70% of jobs require no more than a high school diploma. but public policy has been to send more and more students to college, resulting in three bad consequences. First, we've dumbed down college. Even with lower requirements, dropout rates at four-year schools approach 40% of freshmen, and many graduates don't learn much. One study found after 4 years, about a third of students hadn't improved their analytical skills. Second, the college prep track in high school marginalizes millions of students who feel disconnected from its single-minded academic focus. School bores them. Finally, we're not preparing these students for productive lives. If they're not interested in chemistry and English lit, we still need to motivate them. We need, as economist Robert Lehrman says, to create different routes to a rewarding career. One way is to forge closer ties between high schools and jobs, through, for example, apprenticeship programs that train people for trades like high-skilled manufacturing. The rap against employment-oriented schooling is that it traps the poor and minorities into dead-end jobs. But the reality is, if we don't train many of our students for jobs that don't require a college degree, they'll end up in dead-end jobs anyway, or with no job at all.
Robert Samuelson is a columnist for The Washington Post. His most recent book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath. We want to hear from you. Was your decision to go to college or to not go to college the right one? Go to marketplace.org, click on the link that says contact, or post it on Facebook if that's better for you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, holders of Roger Clemens memorabilia got a reprieve today. The seven-time Cy Young Award winner has been on trial for perjury, as you may know, charged with lying to Congress about whether he's ever used performance-enhancing drugs. The verdict came back this afternoon, not guilty on all six counts against him. An autographed Roger Clemens baseball, by the way, I checked right before I came into the studio, $233. Go figure that one out. All right, in other pricing action, the Dow fell 0.2% today, 25 points, 12,741 at the bell. The NASDAQ picked up 0.75%, 22 points, 28.95. The S&P 500 up 0.1%, 1 point, 1344. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.